This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا لئن أذقناه نعماء بعد ضراء مسته ليقولن ذهب السيئات عني إنه لفرح فخور إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good, they shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
The U.S. calls for an investigation into a rocket attack on an airbase in Iraq's Erbil that killed a foreign contractor and injured several others, including an American soldier. Tehran urges Tokyo to release its asset blocked in Japanese banks and persuade the new U.S. president to lift anti-Iran sanctions. At least 60 people are killed and 240 go missing in a boat accident in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Thank you for joining us. Washington has called for an investigation into a rocket attack on a military facility of U.S.-led forces in northern Iraq. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said the U.S. is outraged by the attack that hit Erbil International Airport in Iraq's Kurdistan region. He said the U.S. supports all efforts to hold accountable those responsible. At least three rockets were fired at the airport. One hit the U.S.-led forces complex, killing a foreign contractor and wounding six others, including an American soldier. Iraq's premier has called for a probe into the attack. President Barham Saleh slammed it as dangerous and criminal. He said it undermines steps taken to safeguard Iraq's security. Iran's foreign minister calls on Japan to unfreeze Iranian assets, adding that Tehran expects Tokyo not to implement illegal U.S. sanctions imposed on the Islamic Republic. In an interview with Kyoto News, Mohammad Javad Zarif revealed that Iran has some $3 billion in Japanese banks. He said he expects Japan, which he called a friendly nation, to release the assets. He also urged Japan and the European Union to persuade the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden to lift economic sanctions on Tehran. With regard to the 2015 nuclear deal, the top Iranian diplomat reiterated the U.S. should take the step first to comply with the accord since Washington withdrew from it and reimposed sanctions on Tehran. Zarif, however, ruled out any direct negotiations with the Biden administration over Iran's compliance under the nuclear deal. Political commentator Koichiro Tanaka says the Biden administration is not ready yet to move forward regarding Iran and Japan, is not powerful enough to influence Washington.
At the moment, we're still in the very early stages of establishing or reconnecting ourselves with Washington and the White House. There is no sort of a direct hotline that we can discuss this with the U.S. President or with the Secretary of State. So I do understand the necessity, and I do understand the urgence on the Iranian side. And I hope that the Japanese government, our government, could do some sort of a positive, mediation on this matter, a very important matter. But at the same time, I would have to say, since this is sort of a reality that we all face, is that the Biden administration is still not ready to move forward, and we too are not that strong in Washington in influencing the U.S. decision.
It's been exactly 10 years since Arab uprisings rippled across the Persian Gulf region, bringing hope to human rights activists within and without. In Bahrain, the country with the greatest number of political prisoners in relation to population, people poured onto the streets hoping for a change, and they were met by a brutal crackdown. Since then, not much has changed, and activists accused the West of complicity by refusing to use their leverage then and now. Bianca Rahimi has more.
February 2011. Emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Center for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerce some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion. But Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
Moving on, at least 60 people are confirmed dead and scores missing in a boat accident in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. Authorities say a vessel carrying over 700 passengers capsized on the Congo River in Mai-Ndombe province. According to the Humanitarian Affairs Minister, some 300 people survived the incident, but another 240 remained unaccounted for. Boat accidents are common in the Central African country, which often result in heavy casualties. Most of the accidents are attributed to overloading, non-compliance with navigation standards, and poor condition of the vessels. Myanmar's military junta has ratcheted up troop presence across the country and choked internet to quell large-scale anti-coup demonstrations. The military has intensified its crackdown after anti-coup protesters once again took to the streets of several cities on Monday. The protesters are calling for the release of officials and activists detained following the coup. To quell the growing uprising, the military rulers have also shut down internet for the second night in a row. According to a UK-based monitoring group, the internet connectivity dropped to 15% of ordinary levels. The United Nations has denounced the choking of the internet, saying it undermines core democratic principles. Meanwhile, the UN Special Rapporteur on the Situation of Human Rights in Myanmar has denounced the military crackdown in the country.
Nightmare, because as fearful as they are of the brutal crackdown that they've seen in the past and the fact that the military could cut them down at any moment, what they're primarily fearful of, their primary fear, is going back and living under a brutal military dictatorship. They will not go back there. And they're just saying these.
Tom Andrews underlined that the junta's move has caused people to unite against the military rule. He also warned that a military chain of command will be held accountable for the coup and repression of protests. The Southeast Asian nation has witnessed protests for over a week now. People are calling on the military to release all the detainees, including de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi, and hand over power back to the civilian administration. The coup followed allegations that the November parliamentary won by Suu Kyi's party with a landslide was fraudulent. Well, Palestinian prisoners in an Israeli jail have gone on a partial strike in protest over the escalated repressive measures by the prison administration against them. Mona Kandil has more in this report.
Palestinian prisoners incarcerated in the Israeli military jail of Aofir started a partial strike by refusing to take their meals in protest against the escalated successive repression and assaults of the Israeli prison service. According to the Palestinian Prisoners Club Association, for almost 2 weeks, prisoners in Aofir jail have been subjected to harassment and repression, including surprise night raids and intensive unannounced cell search, strip searches, and being sprayed with poisonous gases, in addition to deliberate medical negligence.
A big number of administrative detainees are held in Aofir. What's going on there amounts to a crime being planned by the prisoners' officials. They want to bring the prisoners of Aofir to their knees. They have escalated their aggressive measures, such as carrying out several surprise searches of cells day and night.
Hundreds of Palestinian prisoners are held in Aofir jail, including minors. Prisoners' advocacy groups say the inmates have sent a clear message to the prison administration that if these invasions and assaults that are against international laws and the Geneva Convention do not come to an end, then the prisoners will escalate their protest measures within the coming days.
Prisoners' lives are in danger because they don't intend to remain silent against this brutality. Prisoners now are planning other measures to protest their conditions, including refusal to talk with prison administrators and starting an open-ended hunger strike.
Reports say over 4,500 Palestinians are currently languishing in a number of Israeli jails, including hundreds being held without charge or trial under the illegal imprisonment known as administrative detention. Palestinian prisoners have always endured grievous oppression in Israeli jails. However, people in the occupied territories are worried today about their loved ones. They are concerned not only about recent brutal measures taken in the Israeli jail of Aofir, but also about the reports that more inmates there and in other jails have been tested positive for the coronavirus. Mona Kandil, Occupied Ramallah.
The NATO Secretary General has said the alliance will not withdraw its troops from Afghanistan before the time is right. Earlier, we discussed the matter in detail with our guest in the News Review program. Let's take a listen.
NATO Secretary General has poured cold water on a possible pullout from Afghanistan by May, saying that would depend on the situation on the ground.
The Taliban must reduce violence, negotiate in good faith, and live up to their commitment to stop cooperating with international terrorist groups. So our presence is conditions-based. While no ally wants to stay in Afghanistan longer than necessary, we will not leave before the time is right.
Stoltenberg blamed the Taliban for the recent rise in violence in Afghanistan. He urged the militant group to reduce violence and negotiate in good faith under the February 2020 peace deal with the United States. Under the agreement, Washington pledged that all foreign troops will leave Afghanistan by upcoming May in return for guarantees from the militants to enter a peace process with the Afghan government. The Taliban now say, with the withdrawal in question, they will have to continue their fight against foreign military forces in Afghanistan. Joining us is our correspondent in the Afghan capital, Kabul, Amin Alami, and we also have Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher out of Richmond. Gentlemen, welcome. Amin, firstly, if you can provide us with an update and what the reaction has been on the ground there in Afghanistan.
Of course, the story of the presence of military, foreign military forces, mainly U.S. troops in Afghanistan beyond May, has created mixed reactions in Afghanistan. The Afghan government has its own stance regarding to this issue. The country's national security advisor, Hamdullah Mohib, recently emphasized that despite Afghan security and defense forces are enough capable to dependently defend the country against the terrorist groups, it also welcomes the presence of foreign military forces in Afghanistan and said that such attempt is considered as a move that is in line with the shared interests between Kabul and as well as between Kabul and Washington. In the meantime, many others believe that the presence of foreign military forces here in Afghanistan will give extra pretext for the extremist groups, mainly the Taliban, to further wage the war and violence in this country under the pretext of fighting the foreign military forces and invasion forces. But let's not forget that some regional countries also have their own stance and viewpoints regarding to the presence of foreign troops in Afghanistan. Like the Afghan government, many here in the region call on the U.S. and NATO to withdraw responsibly from Afghanistan and guarantee many important and vital issues such as freedom, democracy, and women rights, and as well as human rights in this country.
All right. Keith, when we think of Afghanistan, you think of violence and, you know, failure with regards to the foreign forces. And, you know, you have a lot of the top U.S. military officials. The U.S. are the ones that have spearheaded this invasion of Afghanistan that admit to that. There has been violence, and the Taliban have gained more ground. Isn't it time for foreign forces to withdraw from Afghanistan, in your opinion, because they've done nothing to reduce the violence? I can't think of a market in Kabul that hasn't been blown up yet. And when it comes to training the local security forces to prevent the violence, it's been a failure there as well. Why not leave that to other people?
Well, I think before there can be any real peace in Afghanistan, the Americans are simply going to have to withdraw. That's going to be one of the necessary preconditions. The Americans, what they have done in their 20-year war in Afghanistan is essentially take every problem that Afghanistan had previously and exacerbate it. It's not true that Afghanistan is an inherently violent society. If we go back and look at what Afghanistan was like, say, in the 1960s, we see that Afghanistan was actually a fairly progressive country in the region. What's happened is that half a century of war and violence have done extreme amounts of damage to Afghanistan. But for Afghanistan to be able to rebuild, the foreign interference that takes place in Afghanistan is going to have to be removed. The Americans need to withdraw. That's the first step. We also have to consider that the Taliban are not a group that is indigenous to Afghanistan. They're not reflective of traditional Afghan culture in any sense. They are an extremist terrorist movement that was imported into Afghanistan largely in the 1980s by Saudi Arabia and with the support of the United States. So we need to see American influence removed from Afghanistan. We also need to see any Saudi influence removed from Afghanistan. Now, as far as any kind of peacekeeping agreements of other nations outside of Afghanistan are going to be involved in that, it's going to be have to be countries that have a stake in a secure and prosperous and peaceful Afghanistan, and that's not the Americans.
Gentlemen, thank you very much indeed for your contribution there. Let me thank our guests for their valuable time and input. We had Amin Alami in the Afghan capital, Kabul, and Keith Preston, independent journalist and researcher, joining us out of Richmond.
Well, that does it for this edition of Word News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en. Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday
three things. Leave no sin for me unless thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
The increasing number of children going hungry in Yemen should shock us all into action. More children will die with every day that passes without action, says Brett Wilkins, writer in an article published under the heading, Yet Another Cry for Help. UN report warns millions of Yemeni children face acute malnutrition. Here's the details. Underscoring the urgent need to end a war that is responsible for what it calls the world's worst humanitarian crisis, the United Nations recently published a report warning that more than 2 million Yemeni children under the age of 5 are projected to suffer acute malnutrition in 2021, with 400,000 of them at risk of death if they do not receive desperately needed treatment in time. According to the latest Integrated Food Security Phase Classification, Acute Malnutrition Report, 2,254,663 Yemeni children under 5 years old are so malnourished that they require medical treatment. Of these, 395,195 suffer from severe acute malnutrition, which is potentially fatal. Additionally, 1,155,653 pregnant and breastfeeding women are acutely malnourished. These numbers are yet another cry for help from Yemen, where each malnourished child also means a family struggling to survive, said David Beasley, executive director of the World Food Program, which prepared the report with the Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO, UNICEF, and the World Health Organization. The crisis in Yemen is a toxic mix of conflict, economic collapse, and a severe shortage of funding. Henrietta Fore, executive director of UNICEF, said that the increasing number of children going hungry in Yemen should shock us all into action. More children will die with every day that passes without action. Q Dongyu, who heads the FAO, added that families in Yemen have been in the grip of conflict for too long, and more recent threats such as COVID-19 have only been adding to their relentless plight. Yemen's war, which began in late 2014, has directly or indirectly claimed more than 233,000 lives, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. Foreign intervention in the conflict has severely exacerbated Yemeni suffering, with thousands of men, women, and children killed by
Saudi-led coalition backed by U.S., and tens of thousands more perishing due to a coalition blockade. Recently, U.S. President Joe Biden announced that the United States, which previously backed the war with weapons, logistical and diplomatic aid, would no longer support Saudi-led offensive operations in Yemen. Although he did not say whether U.S. drone and other air strikes there, which have killed or wounded hundreds of civilians, would continue. Last month, the Biden administration said the U.S. would temporarily freeze arms sales to both Saudi Arabia regime and the United Arab Emirates regime, pending further review. In an interview with The Intercept recently, Representative Ro Khanna said that we need a commitment from Biden to use all of his leverage to end the Saudi-led invasion and blockade of Yemen. We need to confirm we have ended all arms sales to the Saudis and that we won't fulfill any outstanding weapons contracts, Khanna added. We need to press for additional humanitarian aid in all parts of Yemen. Despite the recent talk of the U.S. ending support for the war, the Saudi-led coalition has only intensified military maneuvers in Yemen in recent weeks. Saudi warplanes are seen regularly above highly populated urban areas in north of the country, dropping hundreds of tons of weapons, most supplied by the United States regime. In Saadé, Hajje, and the oil-rich Ma'rib province, more than 150 air strikes using the U.S.-made bombs have been carried out, according to the Yemeni Executive Mine Action Center, an organization backed by the United Nations. These attacks could not happen without a green light from the United States regime, and all the talk about peace and an end to support for Riyadh are little more than talk for the sake of diplomatic consumption. The ongoing blockade on Sana'a International Airport imposed by the Saudi-led coalition and supported by the United States regime has caused the death of more than 80,000 medical patients. More than 450,000 patients still need to travel abroad to receive treatment, according to the Director General of Sana'a International Airport, Khaled Al-Shayef, as well as a number of civil society organizations that participated in a joint press conference recently. According to the Yemeni Ministry of Health, over 3,000 patients registered with the ministry suffer from cardiac abnormalities and urgently need to travel abroad for treatment. Over 12,000 patients with kidney failure need urgent transplants, and more than 65 cases of cancer risk death if they are unable to get treatment outside of Yemen. He confirmed that the airport is completely safe and in complete technical readiness to receive flights, indicating that the only obstacle to reopening the airport and lifting the ban is the intransigence of the coalition countries and the complicity of the United Nations. The United States regime has not only been complicit in supporting Saudi regime attacks, which have killed more than a quarter of a million people, destroyed infrastructure, and left Yemen one of the most heavily contaminated countries in the world, it has directly assisted in the enforcement of a blockade that has caused Yemen's complete economic collapse.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you. European News Bulletin.
Hello everyone, you're with us from the British capital. My name is Amina Taylor, and we begin with our top story. Protesters rallied in the French capital, Paris, on Sunday to demand the French president and his government abandon a bill aimed at rooting out so-called Islamist extremism. Demonstrators at the event denounced the controversial new anti-Islam bill, stating that it could trample on religious freedoms and make all Muslims into potential suspects. The bill also tightens rules on the funding of mosques and non-governmental organizations dealing with or being run by Muslims. The bill, now called a draft law to strengthen Republican values, was first introduced by the President Emmanuel Macron last year in an attempt to root out what he's calling Islamic separatism. Macron's critics have lambasted this claim and deemed his actions Islamophobic. Well, Chris Denholm, the filmmaker and political commentator, is with us from the French capital. Chris, as always, it's good to talk to you. And coming to us from the French capital, are you getting a sense here that French Muslims perhaps feels this bill is putting their way of life under threat?
Certainly, because even if the French government denies it, the Muslim community is targeted as a community, and also Macron criticized Islam before. So this is a bill that is nefast because it's so-called discussed to increase security issues, but in reality it's targeting one community, the Muslim community. It asks the imams to subscribe a charter, which many of them refuse. It allows the French authorities to close Muslim associations, watchdogs like the CCIF. So there is a kind of general hysterical atmosphere in France, which is certainly stimulated by the presidential elections next year.
Now, you've answered a little bit there of the next question I wanted to ask you, which is why this bill would be seen as being anti-Islam, but is there a counter-argument that perhaps it's not just targeting Muslims?
No, well, it's not just targeting Muslims, because you also see people black African associations, Arabs, popular people living in the popular areas in France, they feel targeted because this is about security, the so-called security, and there is a big discrepancy in the discourse of the officials. You have very big companies who receive a lot of money because of the COVID crisis, and they are still firing workers, like the Sanofi pharmaceutical company. Now, in the discussion in the National Assembly, in the French Parliament, the last weeks, those who will vote against the law, they use some interesting arguments, like what you see the group of Mélenchon. They said the formulation of this bill is so ambiguous that it can be interpreted on different ways. So it opens the way to arbitrary decisions against the Muslim communities. Also, the other members of parliament said that the existing laws are more than sufficient to sanction people who call for hatred or use racist expressions or call for racism. So why an extra law is needed? This is certainly because there is a general feeling in the political class in France that they might need some more security laws in order to go further.
All right, Kristen Holm, thank you as always. Now it's been exactly 10 years since uprisings rippled across the Persian Gulf region, bringing hope to human rights activists within and without. In Bahrain, particularly, a country with the greatest number of political prisoners in relation to the population size, people poured onto the streets hoping for change but were met by a brutal crackdown. Since then, not much has changed, and activists accused the West of complicity by refusing to use their leverage then and now. Bianca Rahimi has this one.
February 2011, emboldened by what was then hailed as the Arab Spring, people took to the streets in Bahrain. The crackdown that followed was brutal. Hospitals overflowed with the dead and injured, and the prisons filled up. On the 10th anniversary of the pro-democracy movement, the European Centre for Democracy and Human Rights held a conference. According to the speakers, the situation in Bahrain is worse now than before 2011, with hundreds of journalists, human rights defenders, and opposition figures still behind bars. The US and the UK have military bases in Bahrain. Human rights organizations say both are complicit in the monarchy's rights abuses by refusing to exert the influence they obviously have over the monarchy.
Bahrain is a political ally of the West. It's not some other, you know, this country that there is no kind of form of leverage or control over. In fact, the strength of US and British leverage on the regimes is so strong that it actually, I would say, coerced some of these regimes into entering the normalization deal with Israel that was perceived by, you know, across the board in Bahrain, you know, pro and anti-government people as the final act of betrayal.
One aspect of Bahrain's repressive tactics has received international attention: torture and sexual abuse used in prisons. And the UK's complicity is irrefutable. It trained Bahrain's police force, which carries out the torture, and the Special Investigations Unit, which continues to fail the victims. Some are on death row after giving false confessions under duress, and others live on with the horror playing before their eyes every day. We spoke to one of the victims.
It wasn't a prison, it was a morgue. You had no right to say you were innocent. If you did, they would start the torture, psychological torture. They would give us hallucination drugs. None of the guards were Bahraini. And they weren't normal. They were sick. They would make fun of us for missing our kids and family. Those who had kids were tortured the most. They weren't allowed to have visitors if they so much as drank water without permission. I think of those women. God help them.
Britain's top military brass were in Bahrain 5 days before the 2011 crackdown, in which 1,000 Saudi troops trained and equipped by the UK backed Bahrain's security forces. And since then, Britain has given Bahrain £6.5 million worth of technical assistance. Pressure is growing on Westminster to end the collusion, but Downing Street's damning record proves strategic interests trump human rights concerns every time. Bianca Rahimi, London.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we cover the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Richard Sudan, we have some disturbing developments on the George Floyd case. But before that, we kick things off a little bit closer to home and more bad news for the Windrush victims.
Yes, now we've learned about another dimension to it. And we've learned that many of those who emigrated to Britain in the 40s, 50s and 60s as UK citizens worked here in Britain as citizens, paid their taxes as citizens, and now being denied their pension, which is their right as citizens too, back in the Caribbean. Of course, many of those that first came here to help rebuild the country at the invitation and encouragement of the then government, since moved back to the Caribbean after working for decades in the country. And we've now learned that many of them have essentially had their pensions frozen. Now, this is having massive implications because, of course, you know, that generation are an older generation, many of them dependent on their pensions, many of them unable to work because of their age and maybe health conditions, and some are actually being forced to work in the Caribbean to simply make ends meet. And of course, one of the dynamics to this is in the middle of a pandemic, some of our older folk who, you know, may be being forced to work to just pay the essential bills is a pretty serious situation. Now, from what I can see, Amina, the government hasn't really been forthcoming with much of an explanation yet. I dare say they will, but of course, let's remember, you know, they offered an explanation about the wrongful deportations, and yet we learned that some of those deportations or planned deportees were pulled off planes and had perfectly legal grounds to remain in the UK.
All right, hit me up with two of your best choices of the social media reaction, please.
Let's go to Derek Wilkinson, who simply says the sad part of this whole sorry saga is that it would not need much money to fix. We seem to have money as a country for many things, Amina, and there should be some money for this, people are saying. Gracie May tweeted, I'm late to this, but it's no surprise that a Home Secretary currently presiding over a terrible Windrush compensation scheme, ongoing hostile environment in a pandemic, expanding police powers and prison camps for refugees, thinks Black Lives Don't Matter. And just a reminder, Priti Patel in recent days labelled the Black Lives Matter protests as dreadful, and many people are now basically looking at her in her home office regarding this latest dimension with the Windrush scandal, Amina.
Now we go across to Los Angeles, and disturbing, I should say, is the next story you're going to bring me.
To say the least, Amina, I mean, I had to double take when I saw this headline. Los Angeles Police Department officers shared an image of George Floyd with the caption, "You take my breath away," as a Valentine quote-unquote joke. Of course, George Floyd had Derek Chauvin's knee on his neck for a number of minutes, taking his breath away, leading to his death. And it begs the question, what kind of culture, in what sort of conceivable reality could this be viewed as a joke? And it really gets right to the heart of why many people are calling for not just police reform, but for police to be defunded entirely. And I think as we see more and more of these instances, like today, and we saw Officer Clyde Kerr, a black officer, take his life in recent days because he saw the internal racism within the police, it really puts paid to the myth that the problems in the United States police force are simply down to a bunch of bad apples. A lot of people would say the entire basket is rotten, Amina, and a lot of activists really are kind of raising their voices around this issue. And, you know, there is an investigation which has been called into this incident to question why such a disgraceful image could have been shared. But I wonder just how far that investigation is going to go. I wonder if anybody's going to be found culpable and punished accordingly, Amina.
Of course. And then the question would remain, they would only have placed that in that particular forum if they thought it was a relatively safe space. The online feedback on this one, Rich.
There's a firestorm on this one. I mean, Gavin says, seriously, these white supremacist cops need to be vetted. When will black people have their own hate crimes task force? And Cherry Bomb says, have you seen this? A bunch of LAPD cops were passing around a George Floyd-themed Valentine's Day card. It says, you take my breath away. These departments simply need to be wiped clean.
All right, we leave it at that. Richard Sudan, thank you. Now we skip across to Catalan because the pro-union Socialist Party have claimed a narrow lead in Catalonia's regional elections in a vote which saw separatist parties massively boost their parliamentary majority. The Socialist Party, led by Salvador Illa, won the most votes to claim a narrow victory but will struggle to form a government with just 33 seats. The other three main pro-separatist parties working together for independence from Madrid oversaw an increase in the number of seats they acquired in the 135-seat regional parliament, taking it to 74. In 2017, they won 70. The election was marred by a record low voter turnout of 53% as fears of the coronavirus persist. The ex-head of the European Central Bank, Mario Draghi, is facing his first week in charge after being sworn in as Italy's prime minister at the presidential palace in Rome. The ceremony came days after Mario Draghi was tasked with putting together a unity government of economic experts and politicians from across the spectrum to guide the pandemic-hit nation towards recovery. Italy was thrown into chaos after party leaders failed to agree on a new coalition following the resignation of Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte last month. Now the UK has reached its ambitious mid-February target of vaccinating 15 million people, putting COVID-19 jabs into the arms of everyone in the country's top four priority groups. But with this successful vaccination gamble come growing calls for the lifting of lockdown restrictions. And as Saeed Pereza reports, some politicians claim they know the way back to normal.
This country has achieved an extraordinary feat, administering a total of 15 million jabs into the arms of some of the most vulnerable people in the country.
One of few successes in the UK government's handling of a pandemic that's left the country of about 67 million with a higher death toll and worse economic damage than many others. But with the situation improving, should the government open the country up for business? Members of the Prime Minister's own party are calling on him to commit to a timetable for scrapping the lockdown in the coming months. But the Prime Minister says he will only follow the evidence.
We've got to be very prudent. And what we want to see is progress that is cautious but irreversible.
Infections are falling but remain high. And former Prime Minister Tony Blair thinks the way to stop them soaring when the restrictions are eased is to issue vaccine passports, certificates that prove you have received the jab. The government disagrees.
One, we don't know the impact of the vaccine.
I think it's a step too far to have your movement controlled locally by some kind of passport or a piece of paper. I think that's way too far.
Some people cannot be vaccinated because of health reasons. It's just not safe for them. So to discriminate against those people and say, well, you're just not able to go to a coffee shop, go to a different country, that doesn't seem particularly just and fair.
On Monday, Health Secretary Matt Hancock insisted vaccine passports were not for domestic use.
But there are countries that are actively floating this idea and proposing it. And in that case, it will be important for people from the UK to be able to show whether or not they've been vaccinated in order to travel.
That seemed to resonate well with the people we spoke to.
I think it's a really good idea, you know. I think that so as we can travel is the main thing, really, what I'm sort of interested in. Getting abroad for a bit of sun.
I think it's a good idea. I think if it means we can get back to doing summer holidays and travelling abroad, seeing family abroad, then I don't see why not.
Monday saw the launching of the UK's hotel quarantine regime, a new 10-day isolation for British residents returning from 33 COVID variant hotspots. Critics say the move is too little, too late.
The UK is under an indefinite lockdown at the moment to curb the spread of the virus. Next week, the Prime Minister will unveil his so-called roadmap for the months ahead. But with his track record riddled with failures in handling the pandemic since it began, will Boris Johnson get it right this time? Saeed Pereza, London.
Good to have you with us, Ahmed Kabbala. Now, we normally don't focus in too much on perhaps the more popular culture here, but I think the thing you're going to introduce for us will give a real perspective as to why we're singling out this particular item for discussion today.
Yes, we are singling out a film called Judas and the Black Messiah. And the reason why we're singling out this film is usually when there's a Hollywood film and it's related to the controversial assassination of anyone, they usually whitewash the role of the US government. However, this film did nothing of the sort. They showed the role of the FBI in setting up Fred Hampton, who was the founder of the Illinois chapter of the Black Panther Party, infiltrating the Black Panther Party with an FBI informant and essentially setting up his assassination. Now, there were 99 bullets fired by the police into the home in which Fred Hampton was in, along with other members of the Black Panther Party. Only one shot was fired in retaliation, and that was after several of the members had been executed. And there's even eyewitness testimony, and this is also demonstrated in the film, that because Fred Hampton was asleep, they went into his room, they said, "Is he still alive?" They fired two shots to the head, and then an officer said, "He's good and dead now." So it shows the gruesome and callous nature in which the FBI operated to dismantle a liberation group, the Black Panther Party, in the 60s and the 70s. And this is a long history and trajectory of doing similar things in the US. The same tactics were tried against Malcolm X, against Martin Luther King, Nation of Islam, and other organizations. Now, we've got a tweet here from Caitlin Jonestone. She says, "The best part of the Judas and Black Messiah is the bit where the modern mainstream America pretends that at some point between Fred Hampton's assassination and today, the FBI just stopped doing evil things." Now, we've got some articles that show that's not quite the case. So the first article is highlighting that the FBI sent a letter to Martin Luther King's house, a letter that was read by his wife, accompanied with some compromising material regarding Martin Luther King. And the letter essentially was instructing Martin Luther King to kill himself. And then following that, we've got an article from 2017 which says that the FBI regarded a new US terrorist threat, the black identity extremist. Now, this was done at a time when white supremacists were marching through Charleston. And it shows that they've always seen the liberation movements in the United States, whether it's Black Lives Matter, whether it's the Black Panther Party, as somehow being akin to white supremacist groups when they couldn't be further from the truth. I've got a tweet from Joshua. He says, "I wonder how all the people who said the Nation of Islam killed Malcolm feel after watching Judas and the Black Messiah. Oh, you think the FBI and CIA only did that to the Panthers?" And there's an important point to be made here, Amina, that this hasn't just happened domestically, but this is what the US does abroad. So Mohammed Mossadegh, Patrice Lumumba, Salvador Allende, Thomas Sankara, and the list goes on. And that's why liberation movements, anti-imperialist movements around the world, from Iran to Venezuela to Korea, have all sought to forge links and develop solidarity with black liberation movements in the US, because they know the same tactics that are used against them domestically is a similar tactics used internationally by the CIA.
I had nothing to add. Such was the perfection of that delivery, Ahmed. And you mentioned Venezuela there. I'd like to have you get onto that story briefly, please.
Yes. So we all know that the US is leading the charge when it comes to sanctioning economic blockade on Venezuela. However, there is a damning report, UN report, that urges the UK to unfreeze Venezuelan gold. There's roughly $2 billion worth of gold sitting in the Bank of England, gold that that Venezuela has asked to use to fight COVID-19, which is devastating countries around the world, particularly in Latin America as well as Europe at the moment. And yet the UK has refused to release it. Now, we've got a UN special rapporteur who has said that the damage of sanctions has caused prolonged exposure and unharm to Venezuelans, and has asked not just the UK but European banks and entities that are holding Venezuelan assets to release it. and has even said that the measures, the regime change measures, is actually interfering with international law and the right for sovereign nations to equal to exist in equality. Now, what's interesting about this is we always see the UN is selectively used by different entities, but when the US comes out and condemns the treatment of Julian Assange, condemns sanctions in Venezuela, then the mainstream media completely ignores it. And we've got John McEnvoy, who works for the Canary, he was with me in Venezuela, who says precisely that. He says, in February 2019, the month after Juan Guaido declared himself president, The Guardian published 67 separate pieces about Venezuela, regularly citing the UN. Now that the UN has urged the UK to unfreeze Venezuela's gold so that the country can buy medicine, The Guardian is silent.
Final tweet
by Moore, he says, it seems that Brexit English have referred to an old profession, piracy.
Wow, you can't even make a joke about that one, such as its seriousness. Ami Caballo, thank you. And thank you guys for staying the course with us. That is all the time we have for this broadcast. Keep safe.
Limelight. Undeterred by the backlash and widespread delays that followed his disruptive operational changes at a U.S. Postal Service last year, Postmaster General Luis DeJoy is reportedly planning to roll out another slate of policies that would significantly hike postage rates and further slow the delivery of certain kinds of mail.